This summer, I'm going to give a class in mushroom identification at the New School for Social Research. Actually, it's 5 field trips, not really a class at all. However, when I proposed it to Dean Clara Meyer, though she was delighted with the idea, she said, "I'll have to let you know later whether or not we'll give it." So she spoke to the president, who couldn't see why there should be a class in mushrooms at the new school. Next, she spoke to Professor McIver, who lives in Piermont. She said, "What do you think about our having a mushroom class at the new school?" He said, "Fine idea. Nothing more than mushroom identification develops the powers of observation." This remark was relayed both to the president and to me. It served to get the class into the catalog and to verbalize for me my present attitude toward music. It isn't useful, music isn't, unless it develops our powers of audition. But most musicians can't hear a single sound. They listen only to the relationship between 2 or more sounds. Music for them has nothing to do with their powers of audition, but only to do with their powers of observing relationships. In order to do this, they have to ignore all the crying babies, fire engines, telephone bells, coughs that happen to occur during their auditions. Actually, if you run into people who are really interested in hearing sounds, you're apt to find them fascinated by the quiet ones. "Did you hear that?" they will say. In 1954, when I went to Europe, I no sooner arrived in Paris than I noticed that the city was covered with posters publicizing a mushroom exhibition that was being held in the botanical gardens. That was all I needed. Off I went. When I arrived, I found myself in a large room filled with many tables upon which were displayed many species of fungi. On the hour, from a large centrally placed loudspeaker, a recorded lecture on the deadly poisonous amanitas was delivered. During this lecture, nobody in the hall moved or spoke. Each person's attention was, so to speak, riveted to the information being given. A week later, I was in Köln, in Germany, attending a concert of electronic music. There was also an audience and a large loudspeaker. However, many in the audience were dozing off, and some were talking to their neighbors. I went to a concert upstairs in Town Hall. The composer, whose works were being performed, had provided program notes. One of these notes was to the effect that there is too much pain in the world. After the concert, I was walking along with the composer, and he was telling me how the performances had not been quite up to snuff. So I said, "Well, I enjoyed the music, but I don't agree with that program note about there being too much pain in the world." He said, "What? Don't you think there's enough?" I said, "I think there's just the right amount." In 1949, Merce Cunningham and I went to Europe on a Dutch boat. As we were approaching Rotterdam, the fog became so thick that landing was delayed. To expedite matters, the customs officials came aboard the boat. Passengers formed into lines and one by one were questioned. Merce Cunningham was in one line, I was in another. I smoke a great deal, whereas he doesn't smoke at all. However, he was taking 5 cartons of cigarettes into Europe for me, and I had that number myself. We were both traveling through Holland to Belgium and then France, and the customs regulations vary for all those countries with regard to cigarettes. For instance, you could at that time take 5 cartons per person into France, but only 2 per person into Holland. When I got to my customs officer, all of this was clear to both of us. Out of the goodness of his heart, he was reluctant to deprive me of my 3 extra cartons or to charge duty on them. But he found it difficult to find an excuse for letting me off. Finally, he said, "Are you going to go out of Holland backwards?" I said, "Yes." He was overjoyed. Then he said, "You can keep all the cigarettes. Have a good trip." I left the line and noticed that Merce Cunningham had just reached his customs officer and was having some trouble about the extra cartons. So I went over and told the official that Merce Cunningham was going to go out of Holland backwards. He was delighted. "Oh," he said, "in that case, there's no problem at all." About 10 years ago, down at Black Mountain College during a summer session, I arranged an amateur festival of the works of Erik Satie. There were altogether 25 concerts, most of them about 30 minutes long, and a few were longer. For each one, I prepared to talk about the music which was to be heard. This was necessary because most of the people there had a German point of view and the music I was presenting was French. Satie had little fondness for German music. He told Debussy, for instance, that what was needed was a music without any sauerkraut in it. And he remarked that the reason Beethoven was so well known was that he had a good publicity manager. So after about 10 of the concerts and talks, I gave a good-sized talk about music in which I denounced Beethoven. A few days later, Patsy Lynch, now Patsy Davenport, knocked on my door and said, I think I understand what you said about Beethoven, and I think I agree. But I have a very serious question to ask you. How do you feel about Bach? One day, I asked Schoenberg what he thought about the international situation. He said, the important thing to do is to develop foreign trade. One day while I was composing, the telephone rang. A lady's voice said, "Is this John Cage, the percussion composer?" I said, "Yes." She said, "This is the J. Walter Thompson Company." I didn't know what that was, but she explained that their business was advertising. She said, "Hold on, one of our directors wants to speak to you." During a pause, my mind went back to my composition. Then suddenly, a man's voice said, "Mr. Cage, are you willing to prostitute your art?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, bring us some samples Friday at 2. I did. After hearing a few recordings, one of the directors said to me, "Wait a minute." Then 7 directors formed what looked like a football huddle. From this, one of them finally emerged, came over to me and said, "You're too good for us. We're going to save you for Robinson Crusoe." One day, down at Black Mountain College, David Tudor was eating his lunch. A student came over to his table and began asking him questions. David Tudor went on eating his lunch. The student kept on asking questions. Finally, David Tudor looked at him and said, "If you don't know, why do you ask?" There's a street in Stony Point, in a lowland near the river, where a number of species of mushrooms grow abundantly. I visit this street often. A few years ago in May, I found the morel there, a choice mushroom which is rare around Rockland County. I was delighted. None of the people living on this street ever talk to me while I'm collecting mushrooms. Sometimes children come over and kick at them before I get to them. Well, the year after I found the morel, I went back in May expecting to find it again, only to discover that a cinder block house had been put up where the mushroom had been growing. As I looked at the changed land, all the people in the neighborhood came out on their porches. One of them said, "Ha ha, your mushrooms are gone." A composer friend of mine, who spent some time in a mental rehabilitation center, was encouraged to do a good deal of bridge playing. After one game, his partner was criticizing his play of an ace on a trick which had already been won. My friend stood up and said, "If you think I came to the loony bin to learn to play bridge, you're crazy." Once I was visiting My Aunt Marge. She was doing her laundry. She turned to me and said, "You know, I love this machine much more than I do your Uncle Walter. A very dirty composer was attempting to explain to a friend how dirty a person was whom he had recently met. He said, "He has dirt between his fingers, the way you and I have between our toes." Earl Brown and I spent several months splicing magnetic tape together. We sat on opposite sides of the same table. Each of us had a pattern of the splicing to be done, the measurements to be made, etc. Since we were working on tapes that were later to be synchronized, we checked our measurements every now and then against each other. We invariably discovered errors in each other's measurements. At first, each of us thought the other was being careless. When the whole situation became somewhat exasperating, we took a single ruler and a single tape, and each one marked where he thought an inch was. The two marks were at different points. It turned out that Earl Brown closed one eye when he made his measurements, whereas I kept both eyes open. We then tried closing one of my eyes and later opening both of his. There still was disagreement as to the length of an inch. Finally, we decided that one person should do all the final synchronizing splices, but then errors crept in due to changes in weather. In spite of these obstacles, we went on doing what we were doing for about 5 more months, 12 hours a day, until the work was finished. I enrolled in a class in mushroom identification. The teacher was a PhD and the editor of a publication on mycology. One day he picked up a mushroom, gave a good deal of information about it, mainly historical, and finally named the plant as Pluteus cervinus edible. I was certain that that plant was not Pluteus cervinus. Due to the attachment of its gills to the stem, it seemed to me to be an entoloma and therefore very possibly seriously poisonous. I thought, what shall I do? Point out the teacher's error or, following school etiquette, saying nothing, let other members of the class possibly poison themselves? I decided to speak. I said, "I doubt whether that mushroom is Pluteus cervinus. I think it's an entoloma." The teacher said, "Well, we'll key it out." This was done, and it turned out that I was right. The plant was Entoloma grayanum, a poisonous mushroom. The teacher came over to me and said, "If you know so much about mushrooms, why do you take this class?" I said, "I take this class because there's so much about mushrooms I don't know." Then I said, "By the way, how is it that you didn't recognize that plant?" He said, "Well, I specialize in the jelly fungi. I just give the fleshy fungi a whirl." An Irish hero whose mother had died was required by his mother-in-law to set out on a journey to an island beneath the sea and to bring back some golden apples he would find there. Should he fail to return within a year, he would lose his right to the throne, relinquishing it to one of his stepbrothers. For his journey, he was given a miserable shaggy nag. No sooner had he set out than the nag said, "Look in my ear, you will find a metal ball. Throw it on the path ahead of us, and we will follow it wherever it goes." Unhesitatingly, the prince did this. And so, proceeding by chance, they passed through many perilous situations. Finally, on the point of success, the horse said to the prince, "Now take your sword and slit my throat." The prince hesitated, but only for a moment. No sooner had he killed the horse than, lo and behold, it turned into a prince who, except for the acquiescence of the hero, would have had to remain a miserable, shaggy nag. Schoenberg always complained that his American pupils didn't do enough work. There was one girl in the class, in particular, who, it is true, did almost no work at all. He asked her one day why she didn't accomplish more. She said, "I don't have any time." He said, "How many hours are there in the day?" She said, 24. He said, "Nonsense. There are as many hours in a day as you put into it." David Tudor and I went up to New Haven to do a television class for the New Haven State Teachers College. That college specializes in teaching by means of television. What they do is to make a tape, audio and visual, and then broadcast it at a later date early in the morning. In the course of my talking, I said something about the purpose of purposelessness. Afterward, one of the teachers said to the head of the music department, "How are you going to explain that to the class next Tuesday?" Anyway, we finished the TV business, drove back to the school, and I asked the teachers to recommend some secondhand bookstores in New Haven for David Tudor and me to visit. They did. A half hour later, when we walked into one of them, the book dealer said, "Mr. Tudor, Mr. Cage?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You're to call the State Teachers College." I did. They said the television class we had recorded had not been recorded at all. Apparently someone forgot to turn something on. On the way back from New Haven, we were driving along the Housatonic. It was a beautiful day. We stopped to have dinner, but the restaurants at the river's edge turned out not to be restaurants at all, but dark, run-down bars with, curiously, no views of the river. So we drove on to Newtown, where we saw many cars parked around a restaurant that appeared to have a colonial atmosphere. I said, "All those cars are a good sign. Let's eat there." When we got in, we were in a large dining room with very few other people eating. The waitress seemed slightly giddy. David Tudor ordered some ginger ale and after quite a long time was served some Coca-Cola, which he refused. Later, we both ordered parfaits. Mine was to be chocolate, his to be strawberry. As the waitress entered the kitchen, she shouted, "Two chocolate parfaits." When David Tudor explained to her later that he had ordered strawberry, she said they must have made some mistake in the kitchen. I said, "There must be another dining room in this building with a lot of people eating in it." The waitress said, "Yes, it's downstairs. And there are only two of us for each floor, and we keep running back and forth." Then we had to go back to New Haven to do the TV class over again. This time on the way back, it was a very hot and humid day. We stopped again in Newtown, but at a different place, and for some ice. There was a choice: raspberry, grape, lemon, orange, and pineapple. I took grape. It was refreshing. I asked the lady who served it whether she had made it. She said yes. I said, "Is it fresh fruit?" She said, "It's not fresh, but it's fruit." Betty Isaacs told me that when she was in New Zealand, she was informed that none of the mushrooms growing wild there was poisonous. So one day when she noticed a hillside covered with fungi, she gathered a lot and made catsup. When she finished the catsup, she tasted it, and it was awful. Nevertheless, she bottled it and put it up on a high shelf. A year later, she was house cleaning and discovered the catsup which she had forgotten about. She was on the point of throwing it away, but before doing this, she tasted it. It had changed color. Originally a dirty gray, it had become black. And, as she told me, it was divine, improving the flavor of whatever it touched. In 1952, I was asked to write a manifesto about new music. I wrote, "Instantaneous and unpredictable." Then below, I wrote, nothing is accomplished by writing a piece of music. Ditto for hearing a piece of music. Ditto for playing a piece of music. Then there was a bracket and the words, "Our ears are now in excellent condition." My signature followed, and that was all there was to it. When the Depression began, I was in Europe. After a while, I came back and lived with the family in the Pacific Palisades. I had read somewhere that Richard Bulig, the pianist, had years before in Berlin given the first performance of Schoenberg's Opus 11. I thought to myself, he probably lives right here in Los Angeles, so I looked in the phone book, and sure enough, there was his name. I called him up and said, "I'd like to hear you play the Schoenberg pieces." He said he wasn't contemplating giving a recital. I said, "Well, surely you play at home. Couldn't I come over one day and hear the Opus 11? He said, "Certainly not." He hung up. Then about a year later, the family had to give up the house in the Palisades. Mother and Dad went to an apartment in Los Angeles. I found an auto court in Santa Monica, where in exchange for doing the gardening, I got an apartment to live in a large room back of the court over the garages, which I used as a lecture hall. I was 19 years old and enthusiastic about modern music and painting. I went from house to house in Santa Monica, explaining this to the housewives. I offered 10 lectures for $2.50. I said I will learn each week something about the subject that I will then lecture on. Well, the week came for my lecture on Schoenberg. Except for a minuet, Opus 25, his music was too difficult for me to play. No recordings were then available. I thought of Richard Bulig. I decided not to telephone him, but to go directly to his house and visit him. I hitchhiked into L.A., arriving at his house at noon. He wasn't home. I took a pepper bough off a tree and, pulling off the leaves one by one, recited, "He'll come home, he won't, he'll come home," etc. It always turned out, he'll come home. He did, at midnight. I explained I'd been waiting to see him for 12 hours. He invited me into the house. When I asked him to illustrate my lecture on Schoenberg, he said, "Certainly not." However, he said he'd like to see some of my compositions, and we made an appointment for the following week.